This Janet Meffer Today podcast is brought to you by Preborn. We're wanting to save 250 preborn babies this January by offering free ultrasounds to women in crisis pregnancies. You can help by calling 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-2229 or janetmefford.com.
This is Janet Meffer Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Meffer.
Hello, everybody. Great to be with you again. Mitt Romney, what is up with him? I don't really understand what in the world he was thinking when he did this op-ed at the Washington Post slamming President Trump. And part of the reason I don't understand why he did it was because, first of all, he didn't like Trump. Everybody knew he didn't like Trump until he decided he wanted to run for Senate in the state of Utah. And all of a sudden, he and Trump were having dinner and there was a lot of lovey-dovey stuff going on. Not literally. You know what I'm talking about. Political lovey-dovey. They're having dinner. They're putting pictures on the internet. Oh, look, we're coming together. We're coming together. And Romney wins the Senate race. He's going to be the new junior senator from Utah. And as an act of thankfulness, I guess, gratitude toward President Trump for endorsing him in his Senate race, he turns around and does this. The headline in the Washington Post, "The President Shapes the Public Character of the Nation. Trump's Character Falls Short." And I'm thinking to myself, what are you doing? Well, I think what he's doing is he thinks that Trump will not make it in 2020. He won't get reelected. He somehow smells failure in the air. And I think he's positioning himself for some kind of great, I don't know, platform. Maybe he wants to primary President Trump. I have no idea what he has up his sleeve, but I think there is some sort of regret and bitterness, maybe a little jealousy, perhaps, that Trump was elected president, but Mitt Romney, the respectable candidate, did not have the ability to beat Barack Obama. Could it be a little bit of Hillary disease? Honestly, is this the new thing? I got really upset that I didn't win the presidency, so I'm going to snipe a little bit at the guy who did. It's just, it's so terrible. So let's turn to this particular piece, because I'm going to go somewhere with this, which I think is very important to talk about. The Trump presidency, he says, made a deep descent in December. He talks about the departures of Jim Mattis, the defense secretary, and John Kelly, the White House chief of staff, the appointment of senior persons of lesser experience, the abandonment of allies who fight beside us, and the president's thoughtless claim that America has long been a sucker in world affairs. He says this all defined his presidency down. Talks about the fact that Trump wasn't his choice for the Republican presidential nomination. He hoped his campaign would refrain from resentment and name calling. It did not. When he won the election, I hoped he would rise to the occasion. He says he was encouraged by early appointments that Trump made. But on balance, Romney says his conduct over the past 2 years, particularly his actions last month, is evidence that the president has not risen to the mantle of the office. He talks about some of the things he approves of Trump doing, but then he says, as a nation, we have been blessed with presidents who have called on the greatness of the American spirit. With a nation so divided, resentful, and angry, presidential leadership and qualities of character is indispensable. And it is in this province where the incumbent shortfall has been most glaring. He talked about the fact that a president should unite us and inspire us to follow our better angels and demonstrate the essential qualities of honesty and integrity and elevate the national discourse with mutual respect. I don't remember him saying any of this about Barack Obama, do you? Nice words that would have been good to apply to the former president when he was less than honest, when he was not bringing the country together, when he was going after Christians and other people who believe in marriage and lighting up the White House with rainbow lights and being completely divisive and jumping in on things where he didn't have all the facts, his beer summit and all. I mean, how many times do we have to go through everything during the Obama years that would have been good times in history for Mitt Romney to wax eloquent on the issue of character? What, people say because Obama stayed married to Michelle Obama, that's the be-all, end-all, that somehow made him some sort of a moral leader? Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? Oh, yeah, I believe in marriage. I'm sitting at the Rick Warren debate with John McCain. Oh, yeah, marriage. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I believe in marriage. It's only between a man and a woman. Oh, wait, I've evolved. Except he hadn't evolved because he said previously during his time in Illinois that he did support gay marriage. So the whole thing was a ruse and we all got suckered. So that's what happened. At any rate, this whole op-ed is about Mitt Romney tisking President Trump's lack of moral character, lack of leadership, lack of this, lack of that. He says, to reassume our leadership in world politics, we must repair failings in our politics at home. And that project begins, of course, with the highest office once again acting to inspire and unite us. Might I note that when he's talking about the departures of people like Mattis and Kelly, Mattis is not a conservative, folks. He didn't like the pullout from Syria. He's not a conservative. This is the same guy who talked about climate change being a national security threat. This is the same guy who opposed our exiting the Iran deal. Why in the world would Trump want him to stay anyway? You know, he's a holdover from the Obama years. And Kelly was referred to by some in the know as Nanny Kelly. He's the one who allegedly engineered the ouster of Sebastian Gorka and Steve Bannon from the administration. Kelly's critics talked about the fact that he doesn't share Trump's worldview and that he was actually alienating to some of Trump's base. So are there not some good reasons that perhaps those men needed to go? From a broader administrative worldview standpoint, of course. And doesn't the president have the right to determine this guy might be better here and this woman might be better over there, whatever it happens to be? So there you have it. You have the swamp problem again, don't you? You have the globalist problem. You have the Republican establishment problem. Oh, he's just not cool enough. He's not like us. He's not, you know, here is a telling fact. The fact that Mitt Romney couldn't get elected, but Donald Trump could. What does that tell you about who's in touch with the base and who is not in touch with the base? Bottom line, you can say all kinds of things about Donald Trump, and you'd be right, related to lack of moral character. I don't think anybody who really is a true Christian believes he's a Christian. I don't believe he's a Christian when he's talking about taking communion and the little wafer and the little, what did he say, the little cup and all the rest. I mean, we look at that and we go, but he's not a Christian. But he's been very good to Christians. He's been great on religious freedom. He's been great on the Obamacare contraceptive mandate and trying to make sure that religious freedom is given to Christians and people who have matters of conscience that are important to them related to contraception and abortion-inducing drugs. He's been fantastic on the pro-life issue. So when you look at those things, you think, well, this is a really good thing that President Trump is there. Now, I wanted to play for you, just because I found it a little bit funny. Dan Bongino over on Fox and Friends had a reaction when he was asked, hey, why do you think that Mitt Romney would write an op-ed like this? This is what he said. Cut one.
Because he's a sellout. He's a fraud. He's a phony. He's a fake. This is the kind of guy who has absolutely decimated the Republican Party. You know, Brian, when there's a museum left to the remnant of the swamp GOP, and we're all walking through this museum in 20 or 30 years when there used to be the GOP, exhibit one will be Mitt Romney, followed closely by Jeff Flake. You know, Jeff Flake had to pass the baton of GOP sellouts, and they couldn't even wait. The race isn't even over yet. Romney doesn't even swear in, I believe, until Thursday. Right. So they couldn't even wait to pass the baton. And what's even more disgraceful about this Romney op-ed? And listen, I spoke positively about Mitt Romney for a very long time. We ran in the same election cycle. And this is a disgusting move. This is the same guy who went up to Bedminster. Donald Trump gave him a chance even after Romney shellacked him, unnecessarily so. And Trump gave him a chance. He gave him another chance having dinner with him in Manhattan, the president, that is, and interviewed him for jobs. And you know what? He endorsed Romney, the president. You want to talk about character, you big phony fraud fake. You should have never taken that endorsement if this is how you felt. This guy's a disgrace. He's an embarrassment. I'm embarrassed for him, the people of Utah, and anyone who supported this fraud.
All right. Well, there you have it in bold type. Dan Bongino, I think, expressing the same sentiments a lot of us had when they looked at that op-ed and read it. But, you know, if you really feel so strongly that Donald Trump is the worst thing in all history, then why did you accept his endorsement? And if you do have such strong feelings about his lack of character and lack of fitness for the office, why don't you talk to him privately? Why do you have to go to the Washington Post and cozy up to the mainstream media, the same mainstream media that screamed at you having binders full of women and, you know, alienating half the population with your comments and tying your dog to your roof and cutting somebody's hair against their will back when you were 10 or whatever it was? I mean, this same mainstream media beat on you, and now you're pandering to them in order to slam Trump after he endorsed you. This is just a mess. We're going to come back to it. You're listening to Janet Mefford today. We'll be back right after this. How can Christians stand on God's word at a time when radical activists want to compromise the church on the issue of biblical sexuality? A rising tide of LGBT activism is becoming apparent inside our churches. Wearing a religious facade, these activists talk about LGBT Christians and sexual minorities, and their goal is to move our churches away from the word of God. It's time for the church to defend biblical truth without compromise. That's why I'd like to invite you to join me, Janet Mefford, at the God's Voice Conference, a biblical response to the queering of the church. Sponsored by First Stone Ministries, God's Voice will bring clarity to the confusion surrounding revoiced sexuality and identity. Our team of experts will demonstrate how the language of the LGBT Christian movement is rooted not in the Bible, but in the same ideology that has wreaked havoc on our culture. The God's Voice Conference will take place February 22nd and 23rd in Oklahoma City, and we want to see you there. It's time for the church to bow the knee to God's voice. To register or for more information, visit godsvoice.us. That's godsvoice.us. Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to your health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? Well, we're happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty Health Share. Liberty Health Share is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you will access health care so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $199 a month for a single, up to $529 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit lightyourliberty.com. That's lightyourliberty.com, and regain control over your healthcare costs. 855-585-4237 or lightyourliberty.com. Together, we're changing healthcare for good. We're back on Janet Mefford Today. This hour of Janet Mefford Today is brought to you by Preborn. We want to save 250 preborn babies during this Sanctity of Human Life Month, and we're doing it by asking you to help provide a free ultrasound to a woman who is in a crisis pregnancy. 8 out of 10 women who see their babies via ultrasound end up choosing life. It's a great way to stand for the cause of life. You can help today by calling 855-402-2229. That's 855-402-BABY and help save a preborn life today, or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. We were talking a little bit about the Mitt Romney op-ed. A lot of people have noticed the fact that Romney's niece with the RNC took Trump's side against her own uncle, which is kind of funny. She said POTUS is attacked and obstructed by the mainstream media and Democrats 24/7, and said for an incoming Republican freshman senator to attack Donald Trump as their first act feeds into what the Democrats and media want and is disappointing and unproductive. Boy, that's going to be a fun family feast at the next holiday gathering for the Romney family. Maybe they won't be sitting across the table from one another. But this is kind of interesting. Paris Denard over at the Daily Caller has written a piece, an opinion piece. Romney is still struggling to figure out the president isn't pastor in chief. Now, that phrase pastor in chief has been tossed around quite a bit in the last couple of years. I know that Dr. Robert Jeffress has talked about the fact that we're not electing a pastor in chief. We're electing a commander in chief. We're electing a president. So we don't have the same qualifications from Titus 1 and 1 Timothy 3 that we would have for pastors that we would apply to somebody in the secular realm, the civil governmental realm. And Donald Trump is not required to fulfill all those qualities that are listed in the Bible because they're different positions and they're different realms. This has been talked about quite a bit. But Paris Denard talks about this issue and says all the things that I said previously and I've said over the course of the last couple of years, and hails Trump for what he's done as president. His presidency has led to record low unemployment for African Americans and Hispanics and Asian Americans and women. He's gotten 2 conservative justices on the Supreme Court. He endorsed sound candidates and job growth, these sorts of things. And says, I campaigned and voted for Mitt Romney in 2012 because I believed he could do the job as a former CEO. He has led a distinguished life. In any other election with any other nominee and any other president, my fellow Republicans would have done what we always do, support the nominee and work for, not against, the president of our own party. He says, for the never Trump establishment, pride and ego get in the way of supporting the president. It is not enough for Trump to deliver on policy and national security. He must also be our pastor in chief. Unfortunately, the only perfect person to ever walk the earth was Jesus Christ. He is never going to be on the ballot. No president has been or ever will be perfect or even close to perfect, Democrat or Republican. And listening to Mitt Romney, it's almost as if the concept of personal responsibility is no longer a basic Republican or conservative value. We must now have a president who teaches personal character and values, adding, this is silly. The problem with role models is that they are generally still human. Now, I go back to what we have always said as Christians. We, of course, want to have the best possible man in that job in the White House. And you want the most moral person you can get. You want the most honest person you can get. You want somebody with integrity. Ideally, you would like to have a Christian in that position who is also extremely competent when it comes to carrying out the job of being the president of the United States. But we recognized in 2016 that it would be a little bit more complicated this time because you had Hillary and you had Donald Trump. You didn't have some strong third candidate who could make a come from behind victory possible. So now I turn back to the Washington Post to an interview that was conducted with Jerry Falwell Jr. Now, Jerry Falwell Jr., the president of Liberty University and the son, of course, of the former leader of the moral majority, Jerry Falwell, has been a longtime supporter of Donald Trump, came out as one of the most really enthusiastic Trump supporters, probably was the first one, if I'm thinking correctly and if I'm remembering correctly. I want to go back to what Jerry Falwell had to say about Donald Trump very, very early on. Listen to cut two.
I attended the debate in Charleston the other night, and I noticed how friendly and personable Mr. Trump is to strangers. He was the only candidate who walked down off the stage after the grueling 2.5-hour debate to greet the crowd, shake hands, and pose for pictures. Matthew 7:16 tells us that by their fruits ye shall know them. Donald Trump's life has borne fruit, fruit that has provided jobs to multitudes of people, in addition to the many he has helped with his generosity. I have met three of his children in the last week, and I can tell you they are personable, kind, and humble, successful in their family lives and in their vocations, a real credit to their father and to the Trump family. I've seen firsthand that his staff loves him and is loyal to him because of his servant leadership. In my opinion, Donald Trump lives a life of loving and helping others, as Jesus taught in the Great Commandment.
Okay, there's the beginning of what he had to say. And then he went on talking a little bit about the parallels between his support for Donald Trump and his father's support for Ronald Reagan back in the 80s. Listen to cut three.
My father was criticized in the early 1980s for supporting Ronald Reagan over Jimmy Carter because Ronald Reagan was a Hollywood actor who'd been divorced and remarried. Jimmy Carter was a Southern Baptist Sunday school teacher. My father proudly replied that Jesus pointed out that we are all sinners, every one of us. And when Jesus said, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, that meant we are to be good citizens, voting, active in the political process, serving in the armed forces if necessary. And while Jesus never told us who to vote for, he gave us all common sense to choose the best leaders and the ability to choose the best leaders. Dad explained that when he walked into the voting booth, he wasn't electing a Sunday school teacher or a pastor or even a president who shared his theological beliefs. He was electing the president of the United States, and the talents, abilities, and experience required to lead a nation might not always line up with those needed to run a church or lead a congregation.
Very interesting. Now, let's fast forward here to this most recent interview that Jerry Falwell Jr. did with The Washington Post. Here's what they asked him. You and other white evangelical leaders have strongly supported President Trump. What about him exemplifies Christianity and earns him your support? Falwell said, what earns him my support is his business acumen. Our country was so deep in debt and so mismanaged by career politicians that we needed someone who was not a career politician, but someone who'd been successful in business to run the country like a business. That's the reason I supported him. And the Washington Post said, The deficit and debt have increased during his first 2 years. Falwell, yeah, Congress, the spending bill that they forced on him in order to get the military spending up to where it needed to be. He said that would be the last time he signed one of those, but he had no choice because Obama had decimated the military and it had to be rebuilt. They asked him, is there anything President Trump could do that would endanger that support from you or other evangelical leaders? And Falwell said, no. They said, that's the shortest answer we've had so far. Falwell said, only because I know that he only wants what's best for this country, and I know anything he does, it may not be ideologically conservative, but it's going to be what's best for this country, and I can't imagine him doing anything that's not good for the country. They ask him, is it hypocritical for evangelical leaders to support a leader who has advocated violence, what, and who has committed adultery and lies often? I understand that a person can be forgiven their sins, but should that person be leading the country? Falwell says, when Jesus said we're all sinners, he really meant all of us, everybody. I don't think you can choose a president based on their personal behavior, because even if you choose the one that you think is the most decent, let's say you decide Mitt Romney, nobody could be a more decent human being, better family man. Okay, that might be arguable. But he said there might be things that he's done that we just don't know about, so you don't choose a president based on how good they are. You choose a president based on what their policies are. That's why I don't think it's hypocritical. He goes on to say, there's two kingdoms. There's the earthly kingdom and the heavenly kingdom. In the heavenly kingdom, the responsibility is to treat others as you'd like to be treated. In the earthly kingdom, the responsibility is to choose leaders who will do what's best for your country. Think about it. Why have Americans been able to do more to help people in need around the world than any other country in history? It's because of free enterprise, freedom, ingenuity, entrepreneurism, and wealth. A poor person never gave anyone a job. A poor person never gave anybody charity. Not of any real volume. It's just common sense to me. And then they say you've been criticized by some other evangelical leaders about your support for the president. They say you need to demand higher moral and ethical standards. You disagree with them on that. And he says it may be immoral for them not to support him because he's got African-American employment to record highs, Hispanic employment to record highs. They need to look at what the president did for the poor. A lot of the people who criticized me because they had a hard time stomaching supporting someone who owned casinos and strip clubs or whatever, a lot of them have come around and said, yeah, you were right. Some of the most prominent evangelicals in the country have said, Jerry, we thought you were crazy, but now we understand. Now, I would take issue maybe with a couple of things he said here, just a couple small things, because I would have answered this question a little bit differently than Jerry Falwell Jr. answered this very important question that I included in that excerpt that I just read to you when they said, is there anything President Trump could do that would endanger that support from you or other evangelical leaders? And his answer was no. I don't think that is possible to say no. Of course, there's something President Trump could do that would endanger our support if he changed his views in any area where then he was supporting something that was absolutely untenable for a Christian to support. And it's a different line, I suppose, for different people. But I don't know how you can give such blanket support to President Trump that you would say, whatever he does, I'm cool with it. Because he has our best ideals in mind. And even if he's not ideologically conservative, he's going to do what's best for the country. I think that's dangerously close to idolizing the man just a little bit. And I am one who would say, we had to elect Trump because look at the alternative. And I have been extremely grateful to President Trump for so many things that he has done. But I think we walk a very fine line when we are discussing whatever Trump does, we back him because he's Trump. I don't think we can really do that. And there are a lot of things we could discuss about character and about business acumen, if that's the most important thing in a president. I don't think that it necessarily is. But all of these things need to be bandied about, discussed, thought about, prayed about. We need to be very careful to be biblical. We're going to come back on Janet Mefford Today right after this. This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by Preborn. We're wanting to save 250 preborn babies this January by offering free ultrasounds to women in crisis pregnancies. You can help by calling 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-2229 or janetmefford.com. Welcome back to Janet Mefford Today. Have our policymakers abandoned the American worker? Look around where we see stagnating wages, an opioid crisis, jobs moving overseas, declining life expectancy. You look at those things and it sure seems like our labor force is not what it should be. But why is that exactly? And what's the remedy for what ails working people in American culture? We're going to tackle that today with Orrin Kass, a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research and author of the book, The Once and Future Worker, A Vision for the Renewal of Work in America. Orrin, it's great to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. All right. Well, what is your take on the state of the American worker today? How good do we have it? How bad do we have it?
Well, it depends on which worker you're talking about. There are some who have it great, but I think if you look at sort of the median, the person in the middle of the distribution or a little bit below that, who we would have called the working class historically, they don't have it very good, and they haven't for a while.
Right. Right. So you have this situation, for example, where years ago you would have a guy, young guy, maybe not even college educated, being able to get a job in a factory and able to support a family. Those days are kind of gone. We're a globalist society now in terms of business, and many people have talked about how the economy has changed. But what do you see as some of the bad policy decisions that have contributed to the state of the American worker, especially those who are really suffering in their labor right now?
Well, I think what we've done for a long time, really, going back about 50 years, is that we took this approach that said, as long as we're getting economic growth, the so-called economic pie will keep getting bigger. And some people said, automatically, that will work for everybody. And other people said, well, it's not going to work for everybody, but the people who it doesn't work for, we can just tax and spend. We can redistribute from the winners to the losers.
Right.
And I don't think there was nearly enough focus on, okay, but what if you don't want a benefit or a check from the government? What if you want to be able to support yourself? And so in all of these different areas, if you look at how we approached education policy, we pushed very hard toward this college for all model.
Yes.
That says, we're going to gear our system toward creating college graduates, and lots of folks are going to fall out along the way, and we're not really going to have anything for them, but our college graduates are going to do really well and drive our economy. And we did the same thing with how we approached trade and immigration, which was to say, look, more trade, more immigration, it's good for growth. It brings prices down. We can get more cheap stuff. And again, if it actually doesn't work at all for a lot of workers, that's okay. We can take care of them some other way. And then, of course, with our safety net, which we built very much on the premise that, people who are struggling, people who don't have enough to get by on, we can make that up for them with benefits.
Right.
And, one of the real problems with that is then that makes going and working relatively less attractive. And so we got to the point where the kind of package of benefits we might offer someone who doesn't work starts to look a lot like what they could earn if they did work.
Right.
And so all of those kinds of things, again, if all you care about is making sure everyone has enough to consume, that's a great plan, but it really ignores and abandons people as workers.
Well, it does. You touched on a couple of things that I think are really significant, and one was this push to see more and more and more people going to college. What sort of effect has that had? Because there have been a lot of discussions, I know, about we still need, obviously, people in the trades. We need people in jobs that don't necessarily necessitate a college education. And now we've seen the price of a college education go through the roof, which has made a lot more people take on extraordinary amounts of debt. How do you see that push to put, more and more and more people into college as affecting the labor force?
Well, I think we have to emphasize, for people who are going to succeed in college, for whom it's a good pathway, college is great. I don't think we should be against college, but we have to recognize that for the majority of people in this country, college still isn't a very good solution. Most people don't even earn a community college degree. And of those who even do end up earning a degree, often it takes them a long time. Often they accrue a lot of debt.
Right.
Often they end up with a job that didn't require a college degree anyway. And so what's really gone wrong is that we've said college is the only path. And starting in high school, we've turned our high schools into these kind of college prep academies. And all of the emphasis at that stage goes to preparing people for college. And then we've taken all of our funding, all of our resources, and put it toward subsidizing college. So it's really quite backward, actually. We say, you know, for the folks who are likely to succeed in college, who have a good chance of kind of being the winners in the economy, we've got literally hundreds of billions of dollars of support for you. And if you're someone who's not going to college or, you know, trying to finish high school and find your way into the labor force, we have no support for you.
Right.
So we shouldn't be surprised by the result that we've gotten, which is further and further skewing toward the college model, which doesn't work for a large share of people. And with it, a real shift in our culture that kind of says the college pathway is the only respected one, and that anyone who's not on the college pathway, there must be something wrong with them. And yeah, that just creates a vicious cycle, which then pushes even more people toward college. And we really have to get away from that and toward saying, look, people are going to be on a lot of different trajectories. Our economy needs a lot of different things. There are a lot of good pathways into good jobs that are going to let you support yourself, support your family, contribute to your community. And let's find the one that's right for you.
Right. Well, do you think the mindset behind this college for all mentality is really tied to the consumer angle? In other words, saying, you know, you got to make enough money to be able to live in this world, and college is the best path toward making more money. Do you think it's that mindset that is really driving that push?
Yeah, you know, I think there's a little bit of just this idea that you have to make as much money as you can. I think the other piece that's also tied to the consumer mindset is this idea that, you know, even the point of work, of a job, of a career is sort of, it's supposed to be this way that you kind of achieve self-actualization and find your passion and do what you love, and,
yeah,
and that somehow your work and your career is supposed to be at the center of your life. And again, that's not reality for most people. You know, most people, as the saying goes, they work to live. They don't live to work. And the job is something you do to provide for your family, and it's fulfilling because it's the way you provide for your family. And we've sort of shifted away from that to this idea that if it's not how you have your fun and the thing you love, then there must be something wrong with it.
Right, right. Or that everybody has some great passion, and if they just tap into that, they'll have this great job that goes along with their great passion. I mean, that's not realistic.
No, and it's not even good advice. I mean, not only is for most people their passion not what they're likely to be a productive worker doing, but it's not even how you know, some people love throwing themselves and their energy and their passion into work, but a lot of people don't want even their work to be their passion, and, mm-hmm, and it's not always great to find yourself in a situation where you're beholden to your job because you care about it so much.
Yes.
And so again, we've defined this single model, and it's exactly the model that sort of the folks, I guess a lot of times we'd call them the elites. It's the model that the people at the top of politics and the culture and the economy, that a lot of them have embraced and have sort of established it as the standard. And it's just not a good fit at all for what really a lot, maybe even most people need to build good lives.
Right. Well, why do you think policy keeps going in that direction then?
Well, I think there are two reasons. I think one is a mistake made in good faith, which is that I think everybody really did believe in this idea of the economic pie and that consumption is what we wanted, and that as long as we got the growth and we did the redistribution, then, you know, even if your own job couldn't support you, your living standards would still rise. And in fact, that's, you know, some of the criticism that I receive for the arguments that I make is people say, wait a minute, you know, you're obsessing about work, but people don't even like work. We should be looking at, you know, how much stuff they have, how
yeah,
how well they're doing. I mean, to be a little sarcastic about it, how big their TVs are.
Oh.
And I think there's, you know, in a sense, we've believed that is the path to happiness, and we thought it would work, and we were just wrong.
Well, I'll tell you what, hang on just a moment. We're going to take a short break. Orrin Kass with us, The Once and Future Worker is his book, and we'll come back after this on Janet Mefford Today. It's Sanctity of Human Life Month, the month we set aside each year to remember the millions of lives lost through the scourge of abortion. But even while we mourn the loss of so many babies, a new majority of pro-abortion politicians in the House of Representatives are looking to push legislation that would expand access to abortion. It's more important than ever before to fight for human life. That's why we're partnering with the Ministry of Preborn. Preborn funds pregnancy centers across the nation so they can offer free ultrasounds to women in crisis pregnancies. Ultrasound is a game changer because when abortion-minded women actually see their babies in their wombs for themselves, 80% of the time, they choose life. We want to save the lives of 250 preborn children this January, and we know it can be done, but we do need your help. Would you please join us at Janet Mefford today to support the Ministry of Preborn and give life to 250 babies this January? For $140, you can provide 5 free ultrasounds to women in crisis pregnancies. A gift of $22 will provide 1 ultrasound, and every gift helps. To donate, please call now, 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-2229. Or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. All gifts are tax deductible, and 100% of your gift goes directly towards saving babies. Think of the children in the womb this January. You can get involved, and you can help save a life for a gift of $140. 5 free ultrasounds will be offered to women in crisis pregnancies. During this Sanctity of Human Life Month, let's do more than talk about abortion. Let's save some lives. Please call now with your gift, 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-BABY. 855-402-2229. Or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. We are back on Janet Mefford today. Glad you're with us and glad to be chatting with Orrin Cass, a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research and author of The Once and Future Worker, A Vision for the Renewal of Work in America. Orrin, you were talking before the break about some of these major developments pertaining to the abandonment of the American worker, one of which had to do with the economic pie, this idea that, you know, you're part of a bigger economy and so you're all, you know, kind of contributing to the GDP or whatnot. But I know you also talked about the ascent of consumers and the priority that has been given to their interests at the expense of producers. Now, what is that all about?
Well, I think, you know, the economic pie, like you mentioned, is exactly the right way to think about this, which is that when we talk about the idea of the economic pie and it getting bigger so that everybody can have a bigger slice, we're talking about consumption. We're talking about in the sense of the metaphor, everybody likes pie. So yeah, Let's give everybody as big a slice of pie as we can. And no one ever asks what is actually, I think, the more important question, which is, well, who's baking the pie? You know, people like high living standards. People enjoy consumption. But when you look at what's actually most important to their life satisfaction, to their own health, to their families, to their kids, to their communities, it's not living standards. It's not how much they get to consume. It's whether they have a role as a productive contributor. And so you see that in people's own mental health and their self-esteem. You know, you see that especially for men. Having work is incredibly important to family formation and family stability. You see it's incredibly important to outcomes for kids. And so when we just take this view that says, as long as the economy is getting bigger and everybody can have more stuff, we should call that success, we really miss what's most important in life and what's most important to a healthy society, and ultimately what's even going to be most important for a strong economy.
Yeah, that's a really important point. And I go back to something else that you mentioned earlier on, and that was the concept of self-sufficiency. And when you have more and more people on the dole, for example, you want to say, well, there should be some semblance of a safety net for people who truly need it, but then there can be abuses as well. Have we lost as a culture to some extent this idea that self-sufficiency is good in and of itself, and that's a virtue that we ought to be pursuing more?
Well, you know, I think we are losing it. I don't think we've lost it entirely, but I think what happens is that when you think about why self-sufficiency is important, why people find meaning in their work and providing for their family, a big piece of that is because it's something that we've defined as an obligation in our society. You know, people It's incredibly important in people's lives to know what is expected of them, to see what obligations they are supposed to be meeting, and then to feel for themselves in the eyes of their families and in their communities that they have met and fulfilled those obligations. And historically, self-sufficiency, supporting yourself and your family, has obviously been among those. But as we move further and further toward a model that says, well, you know, if you can't support yourself, we'll support you anyway.
Right.
And if you think of some of the proposals we have out there, for instance, what's called a basic income, which is literally, let's just send everybody a check every month
yeah.
so that nobody feels like they have to support themselves. You know, not only will we kind of lose that economic push that I have to work to earn the money, but we'll go further toward a very dangerous cultural shift towards saying, you know, self-sufficiency, if you like it, that's fine, but that's not actually something that's expected of you. And when you say, when you take it away as an expectation, then you also take away the respect and the reward that comes with achieving it.
Yes, very much so. So when you're looking at how the policy is being handled right now, and there has been a lot of emphasis, obviously, by the president on making America great again and having, you know, better deals made with China and some of these other countries, how do you think we're doing at the moment? Or what do you think needs to be done to really make life better for the American worker and improve things in a more productive way?
Well, you know, I think the president accomplished something very important, especially when he was running his campaign and how he talked about the problem. I think one thing that really differentiated him from both Republicans and Democrats and that explained his success was that he was talking somewhat in these terms. He wasn't just explaining how he was going to grow the economy or what programs he was going to use to spread the wealth. He was talking about work.
Right.
And about, you know, people's identity and what they cared about in terms of being able to work. And so that, I think, has been a very positive development. Unfortunately, I don't think a lot of the actual policies that the White House has tried to pursue have necessarily pushed us very far in that direction. I think if we really want to make progress, then we have to step back and say, okay, you know, why is our economy having these outcomes for workers that we don't like? And what would we change if we wanted the economy to have better outcomes?
Yes.
And so,
right.
you know, one thing that we've just talked about is education. You know, if we're especially concerned about outcomes for the half of Americans who aren't getting a college degree, that should be where our focus is. And I know that's, you know, that's something that the White House has started to talk about and the president has talked about. But certainly, we have a lot more work to do there if we're actually going to make changes. You know, I think another area that hasn't received much attention and I hope will is organized labor or unions. You know, unions are something that conservatives generally don't like and have sort of cheered on the demise of these unions, the kind that were set up back during the Great Depression.
Yes.
And that's fine. Those unions don't work well at this point. But the idea of organized labor, the idea that workers should be able to organize, to work for each other's benefit, to collaborate and negotiate with employers, that's good. We should want that both for their sake as workers and for the sake of a healthy society and healthy communities. And so that's another area where I think conservatives in particular have a huge opportunity to draw that line and say, we don't like the kinds of unions that have been creating a lot of problems in the past, but we want to find a way to make organized labor work. And so we want actually to achieve reform there. And
yes.
then I think
yeah.
that would make a big difference.
Well, and as you've seen, the certain industries, you know, lag a little bit more as different industries rise. You know, the coal industry has had its issues and so forth, for example, or the car industries. You look at what's going on, and always we're going to have to look as a country to the issue of creating new businesses and founding mm-hmm. new businesses. This is where the questions about taxes and regulations comes into play and frustrates so many Americans. Do you see some reforms that would be necessary along those lines to encourage people to, you know, start their own businesses and not have so many loopholes to get through that they actually would be more inclined to do it than maybe they are now, given what it would cost them?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think especially when you talk about the regulation side of things, you know, we have two kinds of regulation that we really need to focus on fixing. One is, as you just described, just sort of the amount of red tape. I mean, whether it's the licenses that individuals need just to go practice a lot of different types of work, to all of the things you have to do if you want to open up your own business, we have to make that much easier to do. And then the other thing we have to do is look sort of at some of our biggest regulations on things like the environment, where I think everyone on all sides cares about the environment and wants to have the best environmental quality we can. But we also have to ask at what price. You know, every time you kind of twist the dial a little bit further to try to get things a little bit cleaner, you also raise costs a little bit more and make it a little bit harder to especially do the kind of big industrial projects and infrastructure and natural resources, the kind of things that in a lot of cases are the best jobs, especially for blue-collar workers. And so I think we have to take a hard look at that and say, you know, gosh, in the 1970s, we had real environmental problems and a booming industrial economy, and so we made a choice to start tightening things, and that was appropriate at that point. But right now, we've made so much environmental quality and have so many struggles in our industrial economy, you know, we don't need to go backward, but maybe let's stop tightening the ratchet. Maybe let's say at this moment, we would love to get as much investment in new factories, in new infrastructure, the more the better, even if that's not the best thing for the environment at every moment. And so I think that's another trade-off that we have to be ready to grapple with, that, you know, it's not free. It has costs too, but is the right thing to do if we're really focused on what workers need.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense, because certainly what you just said is right, that we all want to have a clean environment. But when the regulations become so oppressive that they're really stymieing growth and stymieing the labor force, then, yeah, it's time to maybe think a little bit differently. Well, the name of the book is The Once and Future Worker, A Vision for the Renewal of Work in America. Our guest, Orrin Cass, has really done a great job outlining all of these good ideas for us, and you can check out the book. Thank you so much, Orrin. It was wonderful to have you with us. Appreciate it so much.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thanks for talking with me.
All right. You take care. Thanks a lot for being with us, and we'll see you next time on Janet Meffer Today.